Welcome to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark. Get ready for the latest veterinary news, information and entertainment. Don't forget to visit us at the Vet Gurus website, vetgurus.com. Now, sit back, relax. It's over to the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark.
Welcome to the Vet Gurus, Brendan with Mark, episode 342, Thursday, April the 11th, 2024. Mark, the weeks, months are flying past. We're almost halfway through the year, Mark. How are you?
Halfway through the year. I can't believe it, Brendan. I'm wonderful, but I'm a bit nervous. I'm getting a bit nervous because I've got to pack up. We're moving out of the Cape at the end of this month, and I've got to go through all the stuff we've accumulated and see what fits in the camper.
Yes. Do you think you'll be leaving a bit behind?
I do. Yes. I do think we'll be leaving a bit behind. Yes. I do think we'll be leaving quite a bit behind. And you know, my wonderful partner, Kate, who keeps me honest in all things in life, it's one of her features. You know, you often hear about people who live a minimal life, who don't have any clutter in their life.
Yep.
Kate's one of those people who, if you don't use something in the last few weeks, then you toss it. And that sort of runs, because I'm the sort of person, I think you and I are a little bit alike like this, Brendan.
Yes.
That piece of wood that's, you know, just not a perfect shape for this job, I'll put it in the rack that I keep all my spare bits of wood in.
Yep.
And there will be a day when I go, you know what? That piece of wood is the perfect piece for this job.
Yes. I know what you mean, Mark, and I think we are the same in that respect. Yes, and my wife is the same. That's your wife, Mark. She says, you have too much crap. So she puts it quite bluntly, too much crap. We're going to throw some stuff out. I say, but I really like that.
I'm getting that message from Kate as we prepare to pack up the camper to come home. We've got too much crap and you're not taking that. You won't need that. We don't need that.
Yes, yes. Although there is something to be said about that sort of minimalist sort of method of life, of technique, of living. Yes, I must practice it one day. I'll attempt to pretend to practice that method one day. Yes. Okay, let's jump into some news, Mark. Just briefly, contact details, bit of housekeeping, vetgurus@gmail.com, place to go, look at all our previous episodes, say hello. Go to vetgurus.com email us, ran the wrong way there. Email us vetgurus@gmail.com. Say hello. Tell us a little bit about yourself or your practice or where in the world you are. We love getting emails. And just a quick shout out to our three main sponsors, Mark, our Chemical Essentials, Microchips Australia, and Oxbow Australia, specialized animal nutrition. And also, people who have purchased our products, our amazing range of products from our Etsy store, etsy.com, search for Vet Gurus, all one word, and there's some amazing branded merchandise there, Mark, that's fantastic, if I say so myself. I just gave, we had a visitor recently, Mark, as you know, another Mark visited us from the US, and he stayed a few days with us. And when I dropped him off at the airport, Mark, a few days ago, I handed over the famed Vet Guru's bucket hat to him. So I gave him my bucket hat. So hopefully he'll treasure that.
Not a doubt. He definitely will treasure it, and he'll be a
fashion icon.
I know.
There we go. Yes. So, and also our supporters at Patreon, patreon.com. Again, Vet Gurus is the link there, and send us a few dollars to help support us and pay for our production costs. That would be fantastic. So with that, Mark, I think we should jump into a couple of news stories. And this first one, Mark, I'm going to take, it's fascinating. The snake venom and antitoxins, Mark, and a discussion about lab-made antibodies, Mark, and a new synthetic antibody, because traditionally, and we were having a bit of a chat off-air about envenomation, especially in our patients, Mark, but this is mainly talking about humans that have been envenomated. Traditionally, what happens is they're hit with the antivenom that's developed for a particular species. And because of that, the process has major drawbacks, and the main one is that we're developing one type of antivenom or antibodies from one type of venom, Mark. So you need to have on hand, for instance, the antivenom for a taipan or a tiger snake, etc. So, and I think you've experienced this, wildlife places, zoos, etc., need to, as part of their health and safety process, need to have all the antivenoms of all the species of the snakes that may end up envenomating their staff, Mark, and it can end up being very expensive as well, because they don't last super long, do they? You might be lucky to have a year or two use by date on them. So this is a lab, Mark, managed to determine and to target a particular venom component used by some snakes, and it's called the long chain 3-finger alpha neurotoxin.
It was unsurprisingly, these molecules look like a small hand with three fingers.
Yes, and it made me laugh out loud when they mentioned about the comment. When delivered into a person's bloodstream via snake bite, the hand literally gives the victims the finger. That's what normally happens with that neurotoxin. The toxin's middle finger pokes a protein needed for movement, shutting down muscles and paralyzing the body. So they've developed this antibody that neutralizes the 3-finger toxin, Mark, and I think it's a pretty damn good thing. So the beauty of it is it appears to grab a wider array of toxins and work better than the traditional sort of antibodies, Mark. So instead of creating a single so the idea of creating a single universal antivenom may be out there, Mark, and this may be one of the steps towards that. So fascinating.
This is a good thing because we live in a country where there's lots and lots of really deadly snakes. I saw a taipan just the other day, so they're around. But not many people die in our healthcare system is so good that not many people actually end up dying from snake bite here in Australia. But around the world, 140,000 people each year die as a result of venomous snake bites. And so a treatment like this could make a profound difference to the fact that people can survive. So
and much more people are maimed, and it's often farming farming people, and then they can't be productive anymore. Obviously, if they've so not just 140,000 that have been killed, just hundreds of thousands more. So the aim of this is to eventually develop antivenoms that are tailored for specific regions, Mark. So you'd have one sort of antivenom that would put the finger up, the 3-finger, stick the finger up, or stop the 3-finger.
Stop the finger.
Things. Because we were chatting briefly, and maybe if you might want to make a comment on this, Mark, about the trend towards, especially in humans, Mark, the last several years or so, probably more than 10 years, isn't it, that if they have a human that has been envenomated, presented to a hospital, they're reluctant to give antivenoms unless they really have to, aren't they?
Yeah, that's certainly been my understanding, that the tendency is to hold off until the clinical signs and biochemical signs are clear that this patient's not going to deal with it on its own. And I know they're weighing up a chronology, a time course, trying to pick the ideal moment to make that decision. But I would, I know those clinicians making those decisions are, first of all, much smarter and more experienced, and better all round than I am, but I tell you what, if I was bitten by one of those snakes, I'd want the anti-venom and multiple vials of it and pretty quickly. And I know that there are cases of people having adverse reactions to the anti-venom.
Yes.
And that's the reason that the clinicians are cautious. But, geez, Brendan, I'd want the antidote as quickly as possible.
Yes. Well, don't get bitten, Mark.
Don't get bitten. Good tip. Good
tip.
That's
the tip. So what have you got, Mark? What news stories?
I'm preempting a review I hope to do later in the year. This is an article concerning a new book that explores the transformative power of bird watching. So Trish O'Kane has written a book about birding's power to change the world. I tend to gravitate towards the idea. I think that anything that connects people to the natural world is likely to make them understand it better. It's likely to make them want to protect it more. And I think that while I feel I'm lucky to have a connection across a great prism of the wild world, I love seeing all the plants and animals, I can see the birding aspect. Crikey's, Brendan, I think it's exploding around the world, people's interests in birds and seeing them and photographing them and observing their peculiarities. And so I can see it being the main tenet of her book, being a real thing that leads us into the future, that birding can be one of those things that connects humans in many ways to the natural world which we've become separated from.
Yes. Have you got this book back?
I presume not. No.
Birding to Change the World. And I think most of the book concentrates on the story of her efforts, the author's efforts to preserve a particular park, Mark, but goes into the sort of philosophy, Mark, and the reason for it may be good for your soul and good for the planet and good for the birds to get into birding, Mark. So, yes, I think you're right. There's more twitching, a lot of twitching going on, isn't there?
The world is becoming a very twitchy place.
Yes, and I always remember when you took me out twitching up in Darwin, Mark, I chuckled to myself when I saw all these very excited adults running around.
I was one of them.
Yes, visualizing a particular spell, like kids in a candy store, and with all their fancy photographic gear, Mark. It was quite cute. Yes, so there we go. Yes, and you have converted me to Twitch occasionally. In fact, the other day we mentioned off air, Mark, in a previous podcast about how I had a visitor from one of my friends from overseas and from Asia, and we were sitting in a park having a bit of a chat and a catch up, and he was saying, "What's that bird? What's that bird?" And I said, "I don't know." So I pulled out Merlin, Mark.
The good app, work.
And I said, "Have you heard of this app? And we can record the sound of that bird, and away we go." And I was quite impressed. And actually, it's amazing how accurate that is, that bird sound identification method that they have in Merlin there, Mark. Yeah,
it's actually come leapt up in like most of that
accuracy,
AI stuff,
yes,
as it's been fed more data. Yeah, it's become very, very accurate. It's a pleasure to use.
Yes. So there you go. I was doing a bit of twitching there, Mark. And yes, I think it's important that we try and become a little bit more grounded and a bit more aware of our surroundings, don't we? We tend to get blinkered. The journey, Mark, it's all about the journey, isn't it?
Yeah, you're so wise.
Okay, let's jump into our main topic. And I think you suggested this one. And, specific species of snake and some of the particular problems. Some of these problems we see commonly in this snake and some not so commonly, but they may be specific or specific aspects of it that the reason why you've put that on the list there, Mark. And what species is it, Mark, we're talking about?
It's the green tree python, Brendan, one of my favourite snakes. They occur in the wild very close to where I am at the moment. I hope to see some in the near future. But they're a very, very popular snake in captivity. They've become much more common here in Australia in captivity over the last 15 years. They were a very sought after species as licensing came about 15 or 20 years ago in New South Wales.
Yep.
And they were very uncommon in captivity, but as they have been kept and bred, more and more people have them, and the price of them has still not cheap, but it's come down compared to what it once was. I know overseas they're bred, and I think there's some controlled exports from Indonesia, and so there is a fairly sizable population of these animals around the world, and there's a number of captive colour forms now available, so they're bred in sufficient numbers that colour varieties are now coming out. So, yeah, a very popular snake. But I've always said about GTPs, Brendan,
that
they're different. They're weird and finicky,
yes,
and they're just not the same as other pythons.
Yes, and I think because of that, two comments that pop into my head, Mark, they are spectacular appearance looking snakes. And secondly, I'd regard them as certainly not a beginner's snake, Mark, intermediate to, I'm experienced.
Yeah.
Herpetological collectors, and part of it is because of some of the things we're going to chat about in a sec, Mark. But and because they're not a, some of them can get a little bit cranky. They can be a little bit uncertain about being handled, and if they're not handled by somebody experienced, then it often doesn't go well for both the snake and the person there, Mark. But it is a snake that I think beginners may look at and say, wow, that's what I want. And that's when I'd be saying to them, well, perhaps it isn't what you want initially.
Get some experience under your belt with others before you go to this one. I think that's right, Brendan.
Yes.
And I thought the way we deal with this is I've got five problems that I thought we'd quickly talk about and try to just have a quick discussion about them. And the first one is skin problems, and that's the big broad category, but it's very commonly the case that I get to see green tree pythons that have, first of all, problems shedding, and not quite as commonly, but certainly I see it often enough that I would mention it, various skin conditions, infections and wounds and dermatitis of various sorts. Now, I think the key thing to say here, Brendan, and I'd be interested in your opinion, is this is one of those husbandry-related things. These snakes have very precise and demanding humidity and temperature requirements, and they are unforgiving about variation. Where it might take a long time for temperature failures or humidity failures to lead to problems in other snakes of the Morelia genus, our carpet pythons, for example, you only need to be just a little bit out with these guys, and then all of a sudden you've got these skin and shedding problems that are all associated predominantly with humidity.
Yes, yes. Well, let's dig into a little bit deeper with that. Do you want to continue?
Well, it's interesting that they come from an environment that is, that has wet and dry climate, wet and dry season, and they and the humidity varies in the dry from about 60% to the wet when it's well over 90%. And to maintain those humidities in a captive environment is difficult, because if you do not have adequate ventilation associated with those high humidities, you will invariably cultivate a wide range of fungi and bacteria in the immediate vicinity of the animal, and that quickly becomes a problem. And so having an appropriate balance of humidity and ventilation, and having the circumstance where air movement doesn't decrease the humidity so that that then triggers a whole series of dryness problems like dissectosis. That's the battle, Brendan.
Yes, and that's why it's one of the factors that we consider this as a not an easy snake to keep, Marco, for a beginner. And that it's a challenge, isn't it, developing that, having that humidity at the right level and yet not causing other issues by having that humidity at the level that we require there.
Yeah. So the many keepers will spray their pythons with, you know, a water, you know, one of those trigger
spray
sprays.
Yeah. Yes.
But that needs to be done like at least a couple of times a day. And if you're not misting them to hold that humidity up high, then, you know, and it's a very difficult thing to maintain mechanically, you know, remotely. So that means it's probably going to be a snake that, you know, you're not going to be able to have long holidays away from.
Yep.
You're going to have to be there and spray it yourself. Most of the people that keep them in captivity talk about keeping a hygrometer, a humidity, a device that measures humidity, and they like in captivity to keep them between 40 and 70%. The hot, you know, 90% that they do see in the wild is hard to maintain in captivity without complication.
Yes. And those issues, Mark, that you may that may develop regarding inadequate or inappropriate humidity, or the secondary problems associated with that include, as you mentioned, the dissectosis, so the abnormal shed mark, and even infectious sort of processes that we then get, including our, you know, dermatitis mark.
Yep.
Do you want to sort of chat about those and the difficulties dealing with them?
Of skin infections,
yes.
Of dermatopathies.
Yes.
Look, I think the really difficult thing about them is that in captivity, what these snakes will do is sit in the wild. What they do is they tend to sit in one spot for long periods of time there. They'll put themselves on a perch near a pathway that small mammals or maybe birds will travel along, and they'll wait till those prey items come. So they perch in one spot for a long time. They don't waste a lot of energy chasing prey. And so in captivity, they will do the same thing. They'll remain perched on a horizontal branch for very long periods of time, not move around, and so as a consequence, they can develop significant lesions. If you're not sort of paying close attention to them, they can be resting on a significant lesion that you don't even see until it becomes a problem.
And they are, I suppose, shy snakes in a way, aren't they? So they like to sort of hide away and just sit on that branch, etc. So yeah, they need to be regularly examined, don't they?
Yes.
In order to pick up some of these conditions that we're chatting about, and that also desensitizes them to the potential to, you know, being sort of shy snakes have been a little bit, you know, upset if you're not touching them or handling them very often. So if they are regularly and gently handled, then they will learn to sort of tame down, won't they, Mark?
Now, Brendan, the other thing about these snakes is that because they do that ambush predator, wait in one spot and wait till something comes, you've highlighted the discomfort that they can the as pets, because they do have a tendency to be short-tempered and nip on to people, but they have proportionately longer fangs. And so if they do have a snap and bang their mouth on the enclosure glass, for example, if they bite someone and the mouth is traumatized, they do seem to be more susceptible to the development of stomatitis after issues like that. And so we have regularly seen these snakes come in with horrible infections in their oral cavity.
Yep.
And it is often associated with the potential for trauma to that part of their mouth because of their tendency to bite and the tendency to get their relatively long fangs caught in things.
So I think it's a matter of trying to be proactive with any of these conditions, Mark, and getting stuck into the appropriate treatment as soon as you can. And being able to do that means, yeah, making sure you're constantly observing them and looking for any signs of ill health with them.
Now, I do want to mention in the middle of my five respiratory diseases, I have not, this is something that I have not seen a lot of, thank goodness, in green tree pythons, but they are certainly susceptible to gram-negative pulmonary infections, and just like all our pythons, sunshine virus, there's a specific green tree python nidovirus that gives them respiratory signs. And, of course, mycoplasma are known to complicate some of these viral infections. So they're certainly reported in the literature as being common. I can't say that the snakes I've seen, this has been a common presentation, but I mention it in the middle of our five for that purpose.
Yep, ditto with my experience there, Mark.
And it may just be a sample size thing, you know, that the people that keep them don't have a whole bunch of other snakes with viruses that you know, they tend to be longer-term collectors who are relatively stable and not adding to and taking from their collection.
Yes. So there are a couple of I think they're fascinating, interesting conditions that we do see much more often in this particular species, Mark. So do you want to chat about those?
I do, Brendan. The first one is the occurrence of cloacal or rectal prolapses. This seems to be a really disproportionately common thing in this species. It often happens in young adult snakes, and it often is recurrent. I have a little bit of, I don't think, I haven't found any literature that explains high degree of occurrence of this in this species. And I have, as is usual the case, I have my own theory. I reckon this is a bit of a form of metabolic bone disease, a calcium metabolism problem, that a combination of weak muscles from calcium issues, plus the fact that they're sedentary animals, combined with altered neurologic function, probably also associated with calcium issues, means that these snakes just don't hold that vent in with the normal tone that we would normally expect. And then all of a sudden, a relatively large fecal pellet comes along and they squeeze, and then it all turns inside out.
Very interesting theory there, Mark. And guess what? I think exactly the same. I think it is a variation on the generic sort of catch-all phrase, metabolic bone disease, you know, without a doubt.
I'd be interested in one of the things that I have noticed, and it's not an absolute thing, but I do notice that lots of these snakes are started on pinkies, like many of our young snakes are, but I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing for them. I think these smaller green tree pythons in the wild are probably having a go at adult frogs and reptiles that have a much better calcium to phosphorus ratio than pinkies, and I think this might be one of those situations where if you are rearing a young GTP, that maybe supplementing, even injecting some calcium into the prey item, if it's a pinky, it might be a good thing to proactively supplement a growing snake with some calcium to try and limit the chance that this develops.
I think there are some there's some studies out there about the poor quality, especially the calcium ratio of that, of those pinkies, those very young mice, Mark. So, and it's certainly not an uncommon diet for the for this particular species. So I agree 100% with your thoughts there.
I think it's while I don't know that the correlation's been made specifically for green tree pythons, I know those studies, and I think while they're a convenient source of food for many of our young snakes, I think they're problematic for many species and many individuals. But when it comes to green tree pythons, I think that you know, it's not just an occasional thing. It becomes a very common thing if they eat large numbers of these poorly nutritious food items as young animals. And that leads me on to the last problem, is that we see in these guys many, many more examples of kinks in the spine. So you and I both see lots of snakes that have issues with the spine. Predominantly those issues are complicated versions of vertebral osteomyelitis in one way or another. That is, the snakes have had a septicemia, a bacteremia that maybe some people are not even aware of when they're young. Those bacteria translocating from other sites, maybe the mouth or lungs, end up in the vertebral bodies and slowly over the years chew them away. And then we end up with kinks and bends, and it's disastrous for the snake. But in the case of green tree pythons, the etiopathology of kinked spines is probably a little bit different, and it probably has to do with precisely the things we're talking about with rectal prolapse. That is, they have a slightly different calcium metabolism. They're a little bit more dependent on calcium than the other species. They can't bridge that gap as easily. And so if they are roughly handled, or if they particularly if they're trying to get away from you and you apply tension to them, I think there is a real potential for little fractures or collapses in the poorly ossified vertebra that can end up leading to a whole series of kinks, particularly in the tail.
Yes.
So I think this is a common presentation, and when we see it, when we're obviously not able to correct it, but we can make a bit of an assessment about how painful it is for the animal and whether we need to do anything in terms of pain relief, or whether it's just going to be a peculiarity for that individual that we need to watch over the course of its life. I do think that you know, you could easily see how those kinks and how they might interfere with nervous system function, damaging the nerves emerging from those vertebrae. They could play a role in those rectal prolapses we were discussing before. So I think calcium metabolism, while many people might tell you that those issues don't happen in snakes because they're more predatory and eat whole prey items, we definitely see it in this species, don't we, Brendan?
Yes. Well, and I think it's often subclinical in, I think, my theory with a lot of snakes. So if we did studies, or somebody gets out there and compares the bone density, etc., and calcium vitamin D levels in greater detail in a lot of other species of snake, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they have subclinical issues there. And the other factor is also the when we sort of hinted at it, you know, UV lighting requirements as well, that may be insufficient in them. But yes, absolutely. If I have a green tree python that is coming into the clinic, I'm not unsurprised, Mark, if it has some sort of kinked spine. when I see it, yes, because it is a common, in my experience, like yours, it's a common condition. So I'd be interested to hear if any of our listeners, Mark, who see green tree pythons, whether they see these common or these conditions that we've mentioned here, Mark. And even if the opposite, if they say, look, we'd never see a kink spine in a green tree python, I'd be fascinated to hear if there's anything opposed to what we've said there. But I'd be surprised if they're not seeing these conditions, Matt.
It'd be very interesting, Brendan, and I encourage any of our listeners who do see them to get in touch with us, send us an email or just a quick note. Doesn't have to be a complete dissertation. Just let us know what you see, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, send us a paragraph, a sentence, a word. No, yes, maybe. And we'll appreciate every email we get. vetgurus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus. Don't forget to visit us at the website vetgurus.com, where you can subscribe, view show notes, listen to previous episodes and more. You can contact us via email at vetgurus@gmail.com to ask a question or just say hi. Thanks again, and see you next time.